Thank you, and good afternoon, Judges Loeb, Hawthorne, and Miller. My name is Sarah Shelkey, attorney registration number 42077, and I represent the appellant defendant, Mr. Rio Sanchez, who is here today. May it please the court. Question: could you be just as proud of your verdict if you were to find him not guilty? Answer: if he was all the way not guilty. But I don't know if like I say, it's hard to say how the laws read legally. Legally, he might not have done nothing against the law, but if you see pictures or whatever they were looking at or the videos they had, that's where the problem lies with me. Question: well, could you be fair and impartial to Mr. Rio Sanchez or not? Answer: I don't know if I could after seeing the pictures and stuff of the kids. That was the last thing juror 3626 said before he became part of the jury that ultimately convicted Mr. Rio Sanchez of sexual exploitation of a child for possession of the materials he expressly considered. This was despite a challenge for cause properly made by defense counsel to the juror, which Mr. Rio Sanchez is here today to submit to this court, was improperly denied by the district court in violation of his right to a trial, fair trial, by an impartial jury. It does not get more clear than this.
Excuse me if I can just say. Sure. You say it doesn't get more clear than this, but there were a number of statements that were quite unequivocal by the juror that kind of went in the other direction. He agreed that the district attorney had the burden of proving defendant's guilt. He agreed that the defendant was presumed not guilty. He agreed that he would hold the district attorney to his burden, and he specifically said if there's a doubt, then he has to be not guilty. So given that there's kind of a mix of different statements made, don't we have to defer to the trial court's judgment in assessing the credibility of the prospective juror with regard to these different statements?
Thank you, Judge Miller. I think most of the time, in the majority of circumstances, yes. And I think that's why the heightened, although it has not been expressly adopted as a heightened deferential standard, there is more because the judge is in the position to assess the demeanor of the juror. In this case, the sticking point and the real error, I think, lies in the fact that the questionable statements were all made at the end and there was no rehabilitation. There was nothing subsequent to it. In many ways, whatever he said that the people surely will argue earlier on seemed more definitive with respect to his ability to apply the law and be impartial. They were nullified by later statements that were deeply concerning with regard to how we assess the impartiality of a juror.
So let me explore that a little bit. Taking that argument at face value, that the later statement should be given more credit than the previous ones, is there any case law that applies that legal principle that you're aware of?
Thank you, Judge. I don't know of any case law that expressly comes out and says, we're going to make this a temporal thing. You know, whatever you say last is what you're stuck with. However, I think consistently throughout the case law, out of this court and as well as the Colorado Supreme Court, there is a strong emphasis during appellate review on what subsequent rehabilitation occurred, what, if anything, was said later to clarify if that was a misconception, what was said that was erroneous. But the difference, I mean, if you even look at it, one way to look at it is to say, you know, someone says, I agree to this agreement, but before they sign the thing, they say, I don't agree. Nobody's going to come, you know, back later and say, they said they agreed the first time. And in this case, it's certainly not exactly analogous, but it's instructive with respect to whatever that juror is saying last and responding to last. That's the best information we have as to their state of mind in its entirety and how we're going to leave it as a juror. Certainly, the people are always going to ask questions that are designed during their portion of the voir dire, if they're pursuing it deliberately, to identify the jurors that they want to keep and to not ask too many questions of jurors that they, you know, may favor or have a good impression about That's going to bring out the bias or impartiality. Then the defense counsel comes, and we know the routine. The challenges for cause tend to come very heavily during that portion, and it's because the questions are very much targeted to identify that bias and impartiality towards the defendant. The people do not need to ferret out bias in the towards the people the way that the defendant does towards himself. In that respect, just as a factual matter, it's difficult to really say that the latter part isn't more important. In many ways, that's the cross-examination of the juror. That's the cross. That's where we find out what biases they have. That's where we find out if they really understand that burden of proof that they gave the token yes to earlier when they were inquired into it by the people. People v. Russo in the Colorado Supreme Court is extremely instructive on this point as well. The Colorado Supreme Court in Russo said that inasmuch as the jury's responses are made under oath, we believe it's the trial court's prerogative to give considerable weight to the juror's assurance that he can fairly and impartially serve on the case. Applying that exact same logic to the circumstances of Mr. Rio Sanchez's case in juror 3626 here, we can say the identical thing, that it is the trial court's prerogative, it was its prerogative, to give considerable weight to the juror's statements that he didn't believe he could fairly and impartially, that he was very unsure of it, and even went as far as to say that he would find the defendant not guilty if he was all the way not guilty. This is an additionally concerning statement that was never rehabilitated, and that there aren't unequivocal statements earlier on in the record that we can say, oh, you know, it was the manipulation of the question. It was confusion based on the question he was asked prior to that. These are basic questions that once we just even start to get the defense doing that cross-examination type questioning, where one after another, each statement, he would not, this juror 3626 would not unequivocally or even modestly unequivocally say, I can do it.
Let's take that question and answer, and let me explore that a little bit. So before that question was asked and he gave that answer, he had affirmatively said that I understand the burden of proof and I'm going to hold the prosecution to that beyond a reasonable doubt. So why couldn't the trial judge, in its discretion, being the one on the spot, listen to the answer that you're talking about and say, well, all he means is he's got to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think that if those were the only questionable statements, Judge Loeb, I think that that court would be right, that there's one concerning statement and there was one statement made earlier that at least in this heightened deferential context, we can say, we're going to leave that with the trial court and say we're not going to overrule for that. However, in this case, there's the portion of doubt that the juror injected later regarding the burden of proofs. Earlier he says he understands it, later says if he's not guilty, all the way. That's in combination with him saying expressly that he didn't know if he could be fair and impartial. That's in combination with the last words leaving his lips being, I do not know if I could. And when the only evidence that was presented against Mr. Rio Sanchez in his trial was the type of pictures and materials that juror 3626 said would implicate his ability to remain impartial, that's deeply concerning here, far beyond the more academic type discussions we can have about whether a juror truly understands the presumption of innocence and the burden of proof. I think that it can be frequent that any juror is going to say, I do understand it without understanding it, but we don't reverse. We don't overturn convictions for that. What this court and the Colorado Supreme Court overturn convictions for when there's a denied cause for a denied challenge for cause are these scenarios where the trial court didn't give the appellate court on review anything. There's so little to grasp onto in terms of, say, here's an indicator that despite one, two, and three statements later, this guy had a grasp on what we're concerned about. This guy knew the presumption of innocence. Instead, he walked on to the jury after having said to the court, I don't know if I'm the type of juror that I want on my own case. That's extremely concerning. And the fact that the court elected not to do any rehabilitative questioning should not prejudice Mr. Rios-Sanchez by virtue of the highly deferential standard and wanting to say, okay, well, there wasn't any, but maybe the trial court just knew something we didn't know. That's unjust. It's been rejected by this court as well as the Colorado Supreme Court over and over again. We're not going to assume a reason where there's none, but if there's something we can grasp onto to get why he denied it, generally, I think the trend is that the conviction will be upheld. My client's position is that in his case, there was nothing of that character. There was nothing out of juror 3626's mouth that we can hang our hat on to say, well, he said this, so there's a hope he gets it. He expressed confusion beyond the yes-no statements that he provided to the people at the outset. When he had to provide a substantive response, it was filled with doubt and expressed statements of his concern that the evidence of the kind that was going to be presented in Mr. Rios-Sanchez's case was going to bias him against him.
How do you deal with the language in some of the cases that talks about if there's counterbalancing information in the record that seems to be inconsistent with these expressions of doubt or confusion, that's good enough? So don't we have that counterbalancing information here when we have these other responses that, as you correctly say, happened earlier?
I agree, Judge Loeb, that it is about the counterbalancing information and the key word being the balance. And Mr. Rios-Sanchez's case, position in this case is that it's not, I think it would be fair to say that, you know, say the balance is a little bit like this, generally the courts will defer. The appellate court will defer to the lower court. But when it's like this, where we have a yes, a no, and a yes to the people's questions, and then when asked for open answers that have to be generated by himself, emanating presumably from his state of mind and his experiences and background, when all of those statements coming from there are questionable and expressly concede the juror's own question as to his ability to remain impartial, at that point, the counterbalancing information, while there, is nowhere near sufficient. And if I may reserve the remainder of my time.
Please, and you've got a little over 2 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jillian Price, bar number 40815, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. Now, the defendant has identified two statements in this juror's voir dire that she identifies as problematic. The first of those statements is the juror says, again, in response to defendant's questions, I don't know if I could be fair after seeing the pictures and stuff of kids. And the second statement is that I could be proud of a guilty verdict if he's all the way not guilty. Now, even taking these statements, which again, defendant identifies as the most problematic, in the context of the entire voir dire taken as a whole, these statements are not sufficient to warrant a dismissal of this juror for cause. Looking at the first statement, the defendant says, I don't know if I can be fair after seeing pictures and stuff of kids. Now, taking a quick step back, this case deals with the sexual exploitation of a child. To the extent this juror had concerns about seeing pictures and stuff of kids, that's only natural. Presumably most people would find the idea of child pornography to be concerning, if not disgusting. Regarding this jury's ability to be fair, though, he also specifically told defense counsel, I'm willing to look through my feelings of personal distaste and apply the law. That statement sufficiently counterbalanced his later statement that he wasn't sure if he could be fair after seeing pictures and stuff. The second statement is that the juror said he would be proud of a not guilty verdict if defendant was all the way not guilty. The defendant seems to be saying that this indicates the juror did not understand the presumption of innocence or the burden of proof. To the contrary, this juror was a layperson. He's not a lawyer, and he cannot be expected to articulate perfect statements of black letter law on the fly in a court when he's being asked questions. The voir dire as a whole also shows that in response to the prosecution's questions, this juror stated, if there's a doubt, then the defendant has to be guilty, and that it was the people's job to present the evidence to show us that he's guilty. Taken as a whole, under those circumstances, this juror, this layperson, is simply doing the best that he can to express himself. This does not...
Excuse me, Ms. Pride. I wanted to go back to the statement about all the way not guilty. I mean, doesn't that mean that he would presumably vote to convict if he thought that the defendant was only partially not guilty? And if isn't partially not guilty enough to be not guilty?
I think in light of his earlier statements, I think he recognizes that if there is a reasonable doubt, if there is a partial reason to find him not guilty, I think those earlier statements indicate that he recognizes that is the people's burden and he would hold them to it. So if there is, as you say, a partial reason why this person could be found not guilty, I think he understood that that's the burden. And I don't think that he misunderstood.
In fact, I think the prosecutor kept trying to get the word reasonable in with reasonable doubt, and he still came back and said, well, there's a doubt, I've got to find him not guilty.
Yes, that's correct. And again, I think that shows, again, that this defendant, you know, again, not being a lawyer, was simply trying to explain himself and make his position known. The fact that he didn't specifically use the key words reasonable doubt, I don't think that shows that he misunderstood the burden. I simply think that shows that he's a layperson that is not able to articulate black letter statements of the law.
Let me respond to Ms. Shoki's argument about giving greater weight to later statements in the voir dire than ones that occurred earlier.
Well, Your Honor, the only case of which I'm aware where a final statement is given more credence than the rest is People v. Naylor. In that case, which involved the break-in of a car, the challenged juror said, you know, hey, a week ago, my car was burglarized. I'm up nights thinking about it. I don't think I can be fair in this case. And the very last statement that she said was, I don't think I can be fair because of my prior bad experience. In that circumstance, the juror's last statement was given more weight, and and she should have been dismissed for cause. That case is factually distinct from the one here. And under People v. Merrow, where there's sufficient counterbalancing information, a trial court may deny a challenge for cause without further inquiry.
So let me ask you about that a little bit, because Hancock says the same thing, and I know Hancock is discussed in the briefs, but Hancock also says, you know, and that was a case where there really wasn't any counterbalancing information, and so that's a little bit different from this case, but Hancock talks in terms of another thing that the trial judge could do to make the record better, and beyond rehabilitative questioning, and that is state on the record why he's giving more credit or more credibility to one set of answers rather than another if there's inconsistency. And we don't have that here. We just have the trial court saying denied. Where should that burden lie?
Well, that's absolutely correct. We don't have that on the record, and I agree that the better practice would certainly be to either conduct rehabilitative questioning or make findings on the record, and unfortunately, we don't have that in this case. However, I think because there is counterbalancing information, the record is sufficient to support the trial court's judgment, even though the better practice would have been to make those findings or to conduct that questioning. Additionally, and again, this is also discussed in People v. Phillips, even where a juror's statements like this even where juror statements like this are somewhat equivocal, and even if we have, you know, no rehabilitative questioning, the trial court is in the best position to determine which of a juror's equivocal statements ring most true. The trial court is in the position to see the juror's behavior, to hear his tone of voice, his inflection, and any other factors that a juror might outwardly exhibit to see, okay, which of these statements are most true. The trial court is therefore entitled considerable deference in its determinations. Under these circumstances, the record as a whole does show that this juror was able to be fair and impartial, that he understood the burden of proof, and that he was willing to apply the law, to look through his personal distaste and apply the law, is what he specifically said. On these facts, the record supports the trial court's denial of the challenge for cause. Unless this court has any further questions, we respectfully request that you affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you very much, Ms. Price. Wilkie, you've got just around 2 minutes for whatever rebuttal you would like.
Thank you, judges. May it please the court. I just want to address Counsel Price misstates the record with respect to, and this was in the brief as well as here, the prior statement of juror 3626 with the willingness to look through that. At no point did the juror say, I'm willing to look through that. He again said, I think I could. The most unequivocal statements provided by this juror were those with respect to his doubt of his ability to remain impartial. The later statements as well, with respect to the temporal issue that has come up here, under Naylor, are more important, and by common sense are as well. When you think about it, the later statements of the juror are the most up-to-date insights that we have as to that juror's state of mind and ability to be impartial. When that juror provides an honest assessment of his ability to be impartial and says, I don't think I can, or once X happens, that's going to be in doubt, by Naylor v. People, that should be the end of it. Naylor, the trial court here abused its discretion by failing to excuse this juror. She doubted she could be fair from this clear expression of bias. And here's the critical language. It would be difficult for a trial court to assume that this juror could render an impartial verdict. And Mr. Rios-Sanchez would submit to this court, was it reasonable under the facts of his case for his trial court to assume that juror 3626 could be impartial? And he respectfully submits that it was not, and that this violated his right to a fair trial by an impartial jury, and he would respectfully request that this court reverse his conviction and give him a new opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. That